Okay, today is December 1st, 2015. This is the third interview with Lamar Campbell. Lamar goes by Soup. And my name is Troy Reason with the UW-Mass Oral History Program. Soup, if you don't mind, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure, Lamar Campbell. Last name spell is C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L.
That's perfect. I'm just going to move it just a little bit closer to you. All right, so I sent you the questions in advance, and I'm just going to go in order that I sent them to you.
That's fine.
So the first one, you told the story about an undergrad in your dorm the first year wanted to touch your skin.
Right.
and when you mentioned it the first time, you said it was like a microaggression.
Right.
So I wonder if you have more examples of things like that happened during your first undergrad time
here. Yeah, my first undergrad time was... completely different from South Philadelphia life, you know, where I came from, where the minority was a majority, where I came from. And I spoke briefly on my time when I transferred out my senior year, mm-hmm. which was pretty much a stone's throw away. And it was a different perspective, different viewpoint, and a different expectation I found of African Americans in that school system, and which we're there for. That was my first time actually being, I felt typecast. Because my school had closed down, it didn't matter. A lot of people felt that I was there because I was good in athletics. So I was the typical African-American athlete, and that's why I was there. That's why I was admitted into the school. It was the first time that I felt that. Justified in some ways maybe overthinking it in others. You tend to become defensive when you feel as though people feel that mm-hmm. way about you. And it was, like I say, it was confirmed in some ways. And in some ways, I felt like I was also wrong as well, too, in some of the ways that people treated me while I was there. They asked some people that just actually legitimately cared mm-hmm. about my future, not just my athletic future. So it was a mixed bag of microaggressions and people that actually cared about my advancement, but it was hard to figure that out at 17 years old as far as where their angle, where they were coming from, mm-hmm. If it was genuine or not. Mm-hmm. When I got here to Madison... my recruiting visit was great. I don't think that I was prepared for being a minority, but I mean, just a really, I mean, when the majority was so much different, had a very different, campus had a very different feel, a very different look. When a gentleman in my freshman year asked to touch my skin, it was weird to me. I did feel like it was a microaggression. I can say this now that I'm older. I think ignorance played a large part in a lot of things that happened, because what I learned was that they had no experience with African Americans. They had no experience with my background. They really had never saw the lifestyle that I had came from. And so at 17, 18, you know, 19 years old, it's easy to take the aggressive stance or the defensive stance and not take a step back and realize that these are life experiences that I'm bringing that they've never had to deal with in their life. But there was racism. There was microaggressions. Coming from South Philadelphia, although we dealt with it with police and the neighborhood, I've never been called derogatory names to my face until I got here to Madison. Get out of my way, in. Mm-hmm. Who do you think you are, in? You know, so things of that nature never happened to my face. And I think for me, it was so comfortable for them to say that I somewhat felt that it was something that they normally said all day, every day. You know, it came out. It just, you know, sometimes when people say things, it comes out very easily. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. And these were things that I experienced. I remember going to the grocery store and buying some food. And I remember the people in front of me who happened to be white, the change was placed in their hands. My change was placed on the counter to pick up off the counter. Mm-hmm. Was anything said? No. Still said, thank you, have a nice day, which I'm sure is company policy. Mm-hmm. But you notice things like that. I tried to be the guy that sat up front. I tried not to be the typical, people would say, quote unquote, athlete who sat in the back and was always late for class. And, mm-hmm. you know, Professor Werner, one of my professors here during my freshman year, taught African-American history. And he was a white male. And we had great debates on just different perspectives of things. I think anyone can teach whatever they want to teach. I have no problems with that, whether you race, creed, color, sexual orientation, you can teach whatever you want to teach, but you have to also be open to the perspective of people that have actually lived that lifestyle. And I think that openness, he was very open to debate. I remember a paper I did on a hip hop song, and we had to break down and analyze what exactly the song meant. And I remember not receiving a good grade on that paper. And my attitude, honestly, at 17 years old, is how are you going to tell me what this song means? And you don't even understand half of the words that he's using in the song. So that was a great debate. And the grade ended up being changed because there were words that he had never heard used that way. And my perspective was 100% different of someone that actually lived kind of how the song was portrayed. Mm-hmm. So it was just a lot of miscommunication. But I think what Professor Werner also taught me was that the ignorance is not a judgment of guilt. Sometimes people just don't know. And I think being able to have those conversations with him really opened up my eyes that a lot of people were ignorant to a lot of what was going on in African-American lifestyles, and it wasn't their fault. You know, it was just not their lifestyle. They just did not know. I remember, you know, I spoke about my brother passing away. And, you know, you speak to people, some of my teammates, some of my white friends on campus, when I speak about my lifestyle, it was just so foreign to them that that could even really be happening. They thought that, well, those were things that they just saw in the movies or on the news. They were just so far removed from that. So for me, I always try to look for opportunities and problems. And for me, the opportunity was to actually educate and be open to having these conversations and understanding where they came from and where I came from so we can move forward. I know I mentioned earlier that kind of led to my comfort level of being comfortable wherever I was at, being able to speak to anyone, because I think I always was humble enough to understand that I did not know their experiences as well. And that kind of humbled me and how I approached a lot of situations as well when I dealt with microaggressions.
I'm wondering, and you talked about this last time, but maybe just to bring it up again, I'll call it an opportunity that you had. And because you were the odd person out to live in the dorm that wasn't the athlete's dorm.
Right.
I think it might have been another opportunity to be able to see things and people from a different perspective.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
So, Soup, is there... So we're gonna move from your first undergraduate experience and then talk a little bit about this, the interim period. Mm-hmm. But is there anything from the undergraduate experience... I know it's been a couple weeks since we talked, but is there anything about that first time you were here that you feel like you want to get on the record?
Right. I mean, I will say the best 4 years of my life, regardless of the microaggressions, the things that I felt as though could be better. I've never felt like choosing Wisconsin was the wrong choice for me. I feel like I've come full circle for a reason. Everything happens for a reason. And just on the topic of microaggression, when we brought it up, I think I had mentioned earlier that my roommate was not an athlete. He was Chinese. He was an exchange student. And he spoke barely any English whatsoever. And I know coming from the inner city, the only interaction I had with Asians was really when they had businesses in our community. Mm-hmm. So I had never really got to know an Asian personally, let alone one from China, straight from China. And even though our language barrier got better throughout the year, there was so much nonverbal. And it was a typical dorm room. You know, you look at a movie and my posters are completely different from his posters. And my music is completely different from his music. And my TV is on my side of the room, and he didn't have a TV. He had a desk full of books, you know, crazy books. And it's funny how I look back at that year, and I also remember how during the year the TV went into the middle of the room, and we tried each other's food, and we listened to each other's music. And I took up for him, and people bullied him. You know, people said something for him. You know, those type of things, we became very, very... good friends. We didn't really keep in contact after our freshman year in the dorm, but whenever we saw each other on campus, we would always stop and say hello and just ask how each other was doing. So it was also a place of growth for me as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that the bridge programs that I attended, the overbound programs that I attended to prepare me for college, which I didn't want to go to because they were in the summer. Mm-hmm. You had to be away from your friends, and you only came home on the weekends. And that just happened to be at Swarthmore College. And I think that prepared me for the minority position. Swarthmore is a predominantly white institution. But I think when I got here, I learned that I had to grow as well. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a place where I could just be in a silo and just be angry and just say that racism exists. And I think for me, it was my first experience with racism head on, where it was just blatant. In your face, we don't care what we call you. We'll let you know that we don't like you because of the color of your skin. That was the first time that I had dealt with that. And I'll be honest with you, I wasn't as tactful as I am now. I came from a very aggressive environment. It was very hard for me to bite my tongue and really articulate myself how I would like to, because honestly, the double consciousness in me was I did not want to be that angry black athlete. Mm-hmm. And I was very conscious of that. And so that helped me to study. It helped me to learn how to voice my arguments without being threatening. But it also helped me to value my blackness and value who I am and value where I came from. But even more importantly, value everyone else as well, too. Because as I mentioned earlier, some people were ignorant, some people did not know. And it kind of opened my mind to they don't really understand. And in all honesty, I really didn't understand where they were coming from. So it was an opportunity on both ends. And I think that growth over my 4 years here really helped me to transcend or to adapt to a lot of different things after my college career here in Madison.
Mm-hmm. Soup, I may have already asked this, but you just mentioned, studying as part of a way to sort of, as you were talking about this last anecdote. Where did you study in undergrad? Where were the places you could
go? We studied here. It was not as plush as it is now. computers were just, we had about 8 computers, the old black and white computers, the Apple computers. But we had mandatory study hall as freshmen. We studied here. I was studying in the library. Most of the dorms had study dens where you would go in and study. I did not visit the library often. I heard the library was the place to hang out too. I heard I missed some great times in the library. I didn't study at the library a lot because we were always here. Our silo was here in the athletic department. You were here all day anyway, so it just made sense to go to the study halls and study rooms that were here and study. I think we do a better job of it now. We have a lot more space. Obviously, I regret not taking advantage of the tutor system. I think my pride got in the way of that, I was prideful. I could do it on my own. I don't need a tutor. I'm going to find my way through. And how stupid was that? That I didn't take advantage of those things. So I take those experiences and I try to implement those to the student athletes I speak with today. Like, they're going to give you a tutor for any class. I would have took a tutor for every class I was in if I knew then what I know now. I think that was part of that growth. I think that was part of that growth for me that by the time I was a senior, although I wasn't getting tutors, I'm like, man, wow. When you look back on your 4 years here or 5 years when you're here, you look at all the great times, but you also look at the missed opportunities as well, too. And I was like, wow, what if I would have gotten a tutor? What if I would have did more politically? What if I would have known about these groups on campus instead of, being in a silo over here and just taking care of my business and actually taking a year to warm up to people and understanding that this was, football was my safe haven because I hung with a lot of guys all the time. I felt comfortable. It wasn't really until my sophomore year that I found myself getting on campus and being more interactive with students of all nationalities outside of athletics, because athletics is different. And it's funny, I'm doing one of my thesis papers on how intercollegiate athletics can serve as a model for diversity. Mm-hmm. And when I look back at it, I was already doing it and not even knowing it because when we were playing football, we didn't see each other's color. We were all in it for one goal. We didn't see race. I learned some of my great, I love the Doors now. I love Thurgood. I love so many bands that I had never heard of before because the black guys would have the radio on one day in the weight room and the white guys would have the radio on the other day in the weight room. And it's funny, before you know, we're all listening to each other's music. Mm-hmm. So that just helped you grow. We never saw color in the athletic realm. We was also all here for one goal. It was funny that it's funny because when you look back on it, you saw it when you left the comfort of the athletic department. Mm-hmm. But when you were in the athletic department, it never bothered you at all.
I think you mentioned this last time when you talked about the intramural basketball that you played with a guy who wasn't a football player. But mm-hmm. So just directly to ask it, did you start to get to know and befriend other athletes besides the football players?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. I think that's kind of what we have here. And just to be more clear, we have study table with all the athletes, basketball, golf, soccer. You know, we were all there together. We all had training table. We all ate together. We all had class together a lot of times. We were always over here at the facility. That's back when men's basketball was still at the field house. Mm-hmm. They weren't at the Cole Center, where the Cole Center now has a separate training facility and a separate study facility. Everyone was here at the stadium, and we saw everyone all the time. So it was, you became friends, you hung out with the basketball guys, you hung out with the wrestlers, you hung out with the women's softball, you hung out with the women's basketball. We all, it was a family atmosphere. You know, the athletes were kind of, you know, our own family within itself. Fraternity, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All right, so when we actually last left the second interview, you had gone to Detroit for,
yes.
Probably for mini camp.
Right.
Finished the spring semester here, basically. Mm-hmm. So my first question is, so any time between when you left here to go to Detroit and when you came back as an undergrad, how many times or did you come back to Madison for any reason?
I did come back. I would come back. I came back for, I would try to come back for the spring game every year. Our season was somewhat hectic. And I'll be honest with you, at 17 years old with fresh NFL money in my pocket, I was looking to go other places other than Madison. If I had a bye week during the season, usually home, usually traveling somewhere, but I always tried to make it up for the spring game. I always followed the guys very closely. And what was good about the Big Ten, whenever they played Michigan State or Michigan, I would just drive down to the game and stand on the sideline and watch the guys play. So I had a chance to see them play in Michigan and Michigan State a couple of times as well, which was a 45-minute drive from downtown Detroit either way. It wasn't a long drive at all. But it was different, and I think that I saw guys that before me that went to the NFL that always came back. I saw, Chad Kiskaden come back. I saw Troy Vincent and those guys come back. I saw Mike Compton and those guys come back. So it was like, you know, you always come back to your school when you can. There was a long period of time after I played that I did not make it back to Madison. But while I was playing, being so close in Detroit, it was a lot easier for me to get back up here.
Okay. When you were here in those situations for like the spring game, what was the difference, if any, between being here as an undergrad and then being here as, you know, when you were here, it sounds like for the most part you were an NFL player.
Yeah, it was, as far as the experience, as far as what the feel of campus was when I came, you know, it's funny you asked that question because I went to my regular haunts. I would go to Mickey's Dairy Bar in the morning. I would get breakfast. If I went out anywhere, some of the guys still live here on campus. We would go to maybe the KK or another place of Madison. You know, some places that are closed now. Mm-hmm. But just the usual haunts, La Bamba's, get a burrito, big as my head. Mm-hmm. But most of my time was spent over here in the athletic department whenever I came back. I would hang out here. I would eat close by. I had a small group of friends that were still here in Madison, and I would stay with them. So the experience was kind of the same. It's kind of like someone coming home for a homecoming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you want to be around your people. You want to be around the people you know. You want to go, like, cheers to you. You want to go where everybody knows your name. You want to go where you feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up spending a lot of time here in the athletic department when I came back.
Okay. So now we're going to try to condense a bunch of time into not so many minutes, but
all right.
I think it is important to try to get a little bit of context about, you know, basically May 1998 until you come back to get your degree. But maybe we'll start it this way. I'd love to talk to you about your time in the NFL, but that's really not why we're here.
Understood. Understood.
But maybe so. why don't we start sort of at the end of that NFL career? So how did you know, you know, your career was over?
I knew my career was over when they drafted two safeties in that draft. You always watch the draft as an NFL player because they're always trying to replace you. I knew they had drafted two safeties. I had just gotten my large contract the year before, and unfortunately I got hurt that year. So I had missed a lot of games. So it was kind of the feeling on the wall was, you know, am I going to be durable enough to stay around? I actually had one of my best camps ever. And it really just came down to money. I played well. I thought I would still be around for the next season. And Martin Mayhew, and it's funny how it happens. Martin Mayhew just got fired by the Lions a couple of weeks ago, him and Tom Lewan. And Sheldon White, who is now the interim GM, is what we call the Turk. And ironically, we're actually recruiting his son here in Madison now. So we hung out about a month ago while he was here. We just had a really good conversation. And he said, "Sue, you know, we tried to trade you. You know, we didn't want to let you go. But financially, you know, you're costing us the same amount as two guys. And you just haven't been durable the last year. We're going to have to let you go." Even at that point, I thought I would get picked back up just based on the camp that I had. But the way that the NFL works is that was the last cut, and all rosters must be set by that night at midnight. So if you get cut at 5 o'clock, you have only a couple of hours to get back on the roster. Most times teams have their roster set. So it's funny, we spend that next season, and you find yourself watching the injury report. You find yourself, see if anyone's getting hurt, you're calling your agent. You know, they're going to bring me in for a workout. And then you start thinking about life after. You know, as I was in Detroit, I tried to finish my degree numerous times. I tried to finish at Wayne State. I tried to finish at Michigan. I tried to finish at Oakland University. But Wisconsin has a rule that you have to finish your last 16 credits on campus. So I, through my entire 5 years in Detroit, my degree was always important to me. Unfortunately, I would have to come back to Madison for an entire semester to do that. Where a lot of schools don't do, I think we're one of, I think 12 schools nationally that you have to finish your remaining credits on campus, which upset me in a lot of ways. Like, you know, I really want to finish my degree. I can play ball and I can finish my degree while I'm playing in the offseason. I can be local where I'm not jeopardizing my career. And honestly, I think that's something that we should look into for any student, not just student athletes, for any student. You know, you can spend a lot of your time here. I think it should be a majority of your credits should be here. I'm 100% for that, but you never know. Lifestyle, I know, but what I've learned is life happens. And sometimes you can't be in Madison, but you still want to finish your degree. So to be, to have the opportunity to finish it somewhere else, I think should definitely be an option. It should be something that we should look into as a university moving forward. That's my rant about that. But but you know what? Even with that being said, I found myself back here to finish it a lot longer than I had planned. But when I say life happens, I left the NFL. I had real estate investments. I went back to the front office of the Detroit Lions and worked in the scouting department. And I had a son. And so a lot of things came, life came into play where it just wasn't feasible for me to get back to Madison and leave for an entire semester. My father was not around when I was young. That was something for me personally that it was important for me to be around for those first moments, those first steps, those first words, having that presence in his life early on, because I did not have that. So I left scouting, and when I went to Atlanta, that was my whole purpose, to be a father. You know, the best job I've ever had, and no job will ever top it. You know, still the best job I have. But when he became old enough and I wanted more for him and more opportunities for myself to create for him, I looked at it two ways. It was very difficult. I know you asked about the sacrifices. That's probably the biggest sacrifice, being here right now. Technology definitely makes it a lot easier with Skype and seeing each other and flying. But I think more importantly for me, that he understands, he's at the age now where he understands why I'm back here. And that for me is the most important part. And I think that's what I was waiting for Even when I came back from my undergrad, I talked to a lot of people, but he was the most important person that I spoke with as far as my decision to come back to Madison, was my son. And if he understood why I was coming back, and if he understood why it was important for me to come back and finish this, what I had started. And I preached to him as long as he can remember to always finish what you start, to never quit. If you start a sport, I don't care if you hate it, you're going to play it because I paid for it, and we don't quit. And it was hard for me to keep telling him that, knowing in the back of my mind this was something that I had never finished, even though I never quit on it. It was just something that I had never finished. Mm-hmm. And that was important to me. And that, even though that was a big sacrifice, and I look long term on what it means to him, to see his dad graduate, to see his dad back in grad school. I mean, these are things that I hope when he gets older can understand why it was so important as he gets older, and maybe take the same path that I took on education or any path, that it is important. So the foundation of it all, that education is important. That's what I really want him to understand, because he's a lot more privileged than I was. He's in a good school district. He has the books without ripped pages that I had. He has that support system that I did not have. And like any father, you want your kids to be greater than you are, and that's what I want for him.
Mm-hmm. So, Sue, let's get into specifics then about. So you were in Atlanta. What were you doing in Atlanta? You know, let's say 2013, whenever the mm-hmm. really starts to coalesce that I'm going to try to come back here.
Right. In 2013, I was doing my real estate business. I had a budding career in journalism. I had written some articles for CNN. Had gone on air for athlete issues. I've gone on air for finances. This was around the time that the NFL owners locked out the NFL players. It was right after that. That was important for me. And I was also working with the NFLPA, the NFL Players Union. In Atlanta. Real estate, while the investments were good, I'll say that I was still looking for something that I love to do as much as playing football. Real estate was good, but it wasn't my passion. Giving back has always been a huge passion of mine. Being an educator, I came to school wanting to be, as I mentioned earlier, Indiana Jones, a teacher, professor possibly. Mm-hmm. And looked at teaching the game of life when it comes to professional athletes and making the transition from football and making sure you're building your social capital while you're here on campus were things that I did. And I traveled around with the NCAA, and I spoke about those things. I think for me, when you do these speaking for engagements with the NCAA, you're there for one or two days. You come in maybe on a Tuesday night. You speak to the team on Wednesday, you hang out with them, and then you leave. I began to lack satisfaction mm-hmm. in not being there every day to reinforce. Mm-hmm. I think that support system is huge, and I knew I wanted to do that full time. Without my degree, that was impossible. I have friends in NCAA. I have people that, without degrees that I hear, had gotten jobs like that, but it's a very competitive field. And to be 100% honest, I didn't know if I was prepared for the everyday grind. So not only did I need to go back to school, but I also needed the experience as well. You can have an MBA, a PhD, a master's, but a lot of times, 9 times out of 10, this comes from my experience in the corporate world. Without any experience, you're not going to get hired. Mm-hmm. So I can have all these credentials, but if I have no experience at working with these student athletes day in and day out, it's going to be very hard for me to be able to do that. So coming back to undergrad last year and having a chance to just volunteer here. I wasn't on staff, but they opened to me volunteering here and dealing with a lot of microaggressions in that form as well, too, because you'll be surprised that people will be intimidated by your presence. People may be intimidated by what you've done, what you've accomplished. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it was important for me to no longer be looked at as a student athlete. The last time they saw me, that's who I was. So they had no idea what I was doing outside. They had no idea what I was doing with the NCAA, with CNN, with HLN, with NFL Network, all the journalism things. It was important for me to show that I was passionate about this. This is what I wanted to do, and let it be clear to them that I'm here to help. I'm here to be an asset, not a liability. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes from Coach Alvarez and my upbringing, and kind of went hand in hand where, you know, we don't bring problems, we bring solutions, you know, and that's what I wanted to be a part of. And it's important to a lot of people being former athletes that they get out of that athlete mindset. I've dealt with that in the corporate world as well, too, that they looked at me as an athlete and not as a professional. You know, so it was important for me to make that distinction and make sure I did things three times better. Just like I did in football, I had to do a lot a little better than you, a little faster, a little more detail. You know, I just had to be better in every way, not only just being an African-American male, but also being an African-American male who just happened to be a professional football player. So it came at you from different angles. But I think I think it's just the realism of the world. And being in Atlanta, below the Bible Belt, it was very different being an African-American in Atlanta than it was being an African-American in the northern cities. Racism down there, they fly the Confederate flag very high. There were certain universities down there that wanted me to come speak. I would not come speak on their campus because of the Confederate flag was there on campus. That was just something that I was very conscious of, but I think it stood for something that I didn't want to be a part of. So I know for me coming here to Liberal Mass in Wisconsin, and I will say being comfortable knowing the campus and knowing the people here was very important to me. But more than anything, the opportunity to give back to the university that gave me so much. University of Wisconsin came and got me out of South Philadelphia. Who knows what would have happened if I didn't have the opportunity to come here.
Yeah, Sue, you know, I really hadn't thought about it that you'd spent, I don't know how long you lived in Atlanta before you came back here, but, I mean, you'd spent in Philly and then Madison and then Detroit. So Atlanta, I'm assuming, is your first. I mean, how long did you live in Atlanta?
I got to Atlanta in 2007. Okay. Spring of 2007.
So six.
Right when I left the scouting department.
Like
with
6-7 years before you moved back up here.
Yeah.
So that's enough lived experience to be able to sort of judge, you know, what it is to be an African American in the South and what it is to be African American in
Definitely.
The North.
Definitely.
It sounds like there were similarities and differences.
Yes. Yes. Along both lines. I think up North is more class biased. I don't think a lot of people see color up North. I think a lot of people see your class, your financial status, where you live. I felt as though, and it's my personal opinion, I felt as though in the South it was more racial, along with class. I mean, they would call you boy to your face. I experienced that in Atlanta at 29, 30 years old, a boy, you know, and I'm still, you know, a little older now, a little more reserved, getting ready to be a new dad, so I'm thinking things through a little bit more, but boy, very comfortably, Confederate flag flying very comfortably on whether it's on buildings, whether it's on license plates, whether it's the gatherings of the KKK, a lot of I mean, it was just very different living in the South, and it can be very segregated as well in the South. People will say, you know, this is the black neighborhood, these are the white neighborhoods. But it was more, I felt as though it was more racial in the South, where in the North I felt it was more class-based in the Philadelphia, Northeast area. Okay. Like I said, that was all my personal opinions and personal observations. But I think valid in the fact that this is the world that we live in. You know, people ask me now that I'm back in grad school, well, what's your pedagogy? You know, what do you teach? What is your angle? I say, you know, I think I really believe in building social capital and not hiding what the real world is to a lot of my student athletes. It's not going to be nice. You're going to deal with people that white, black, Asian that are going to have microaggressions towards you, that are going to have different opinions towards you. And I try to use my experience of being open-minded and understanding their ignorance or their choice to be that way towards you and to handle yourself correctly. Because at the end of the day, you're going to be responsible for your actions. So how do you handle that in the world? How do you handle that when you're the only African-American in a room? How do you handle that when you're the only a white person in the room? I asked that you're the only Asian person in the room, the international person in the room. Mm-hmm. Those are experiences that you're going to have. And that's just the way life is. But how you handle yourself, you can't control. You can't control what situation you're put into, but you can't control how you handle that situation.
So, one more thing, and this shows a bit of my ignorance, is that I would see being an NFL athlete, a former NFL athlete, being a plus in terms of sort of moving into the world outside of being an athlete, you know, your occupational world after that.
Right.
Sounds like that you're saying that while there probably is some pluses to it, there's some minuses to it as well.
I would say being a current NFL athlete definitely opens a door. I do believe the shield. I don't pull any punches. My student athletes will tell you that. I believe the shield opens a lot of doors for you. It'll open up a lot more doors when you're active rather than when you're retired. I think it's important to build that relationship with people before your time in the NFL is over. But once you get there, just like anything, it has nothing to do with the NFL. It has nothing to do with race. You have to prove yourself. They're not going to bring you in just to bring you in. And if they do bring you in just to bring you in, you fail to set yourself up to rise. You fail yourself up to climb the corporate ladder, if you will, if you're just going to be a guy there. You have to know your worth. You have to know what you bring to the table. Playing in the NFL is great. A lot of guys will bring you into their corporation to talk and speak and just be around and say, I have an NFL guy working here. But I use the example, well, will he give you that portfolio? Will he give you that big deal? Can he trust you to go to Europe or China and close a deal for him? Whatever, you know, whatever the scenario you want to use, and that's the guy that you want to be. The disadvantage is that if you go and play a 10-year NFL career and you majored in marketing and you came out in, I'll just use my year, you came out in 1998, I played till 2008, I haven't done marketing in 10 years. There are guys that not only went to undergrad for marketing, but they went to grad school for marketing and they started out as interns and they worked their way up. Here I am at 20, I lose 10 years of real work experience. Mm-hmm. So you have to work twice as hard when you get in there. You play football for 10 years. Mm-hmm. When's the last marketing presentation you gave? Mm-hmm. When's the last time you picked up a marketing book? How are you following the trends? What's new in marketing today? You have people that have been in that career for 10 to 12 years that have earned those positions, and rightfully so. That's your competition. So you have to come out of the NFL prepared and prepare yourself while you're in there to make that transition. So it could be a plus and a minus. But you have to navigate that depending on who you are and set yourself up early to be successful.
So maybe one more thing before we get to coming back here, and that may actually take us to the end of our time today, and that's you talked a lot about, you didn't talk a lot, but you said one of the things you became involved in was journalism.
Mm.
So how did you become involved in that? And then if you want to talk a little bit more about some of the things you did in it.
Oh, wow. You know, it was funny. I thought about television broadcasting while I was here. I thought about school of journalism. I came in as a history and film guy. I wanted to learn about history, and I was always big on old films. Turner Classic Movies is my favorite channel. I love the Turner Classics. Everyone thinks it's weird, but that's why my favorite is favorite channel. Casablanca is still one of my favorite movies. The Hitchcock movies are my faves as well. And it just so happened that during my community service in Atlanta, I had met some people from CNN. And at the time, just through community service and giving back, and during this time, as I mentioned, this was when the NFL owners had locked out the players. A lot of players financially were taking out loans at 30% interest because they weren't getting paid. Just so happened that I knew someone in CNN, and we just had this conversation randomly, and they asked me would I like to come on air and speak about it. At the time, I was with the NFLPA in Atlanta. I was on that board, and I had never thought about journalism, and to me, it really wasn't journalism at that time. It was more so just educating the world on what's going on with these NFL players while they're locked out. That led to me being a recurring guest on CNN. I've gone on with Don Lemon. I've gone on with Anderson Cooper. I've gone on with so many of them. You know, I've gone on with HLN. That led to me writing articles. The first article I penned for CNN was the beginning of the NFL season. I believe it was 2000. May have been 2013, beginning of the NFL season, and I talked about the transition a lot of these guys are making from the NFL. Mm-hmm. While some of these guys are living their dream, a lot of these guys' dreams are over. That was the first article that I penned for them. I penned an article on depression and mental health amongst NFL players and athletes. I wrote an article on social media, how athletes now are not afraid to go on social media and voice their political opinions. You know, Michael Jordan had the famous quote, Republicans buy sneakers too, back in the 80s. You know, that was something that Michael Jordan wouldn't have touched. You know, I'm not going to say anything political. My shoes aren't going to sell as well. Now you have a transcendent professional player where you have the Miami Heat supporting Trayvon Martin. When you have athletes standing up for different social issues. So I think the time has changed and social media has made that possible. I don't think we've seen that since Tommy Smith and those guys in the Olympics. You know, a guy where athlete actually took that stand and actually interviewed him for that article. And it was amazing to see that when you hear him and Jim Brown, when you hear Tommy Smith and you hear Jim Brown, and you hear these guys talk about how they stood up for as they were activists, you know, in their day and why it was important for them and their celebrity to stand up and be heard. You know, the younger generation may hear that as angry old men, but when you're dealing with it on an everyday basis, you understand. I think they understood then, in the midst of the whole civil rights movement, that their positions had power. I think you're finding that power shift now, even locally, now even going to college level, while we've been doing this oral history, the University of Missouri has stood up, and the chancellor and the president had to leave because of racial incidents on campus that were just going unheard. So I think the power shift is in motion. I think the athletes now, professionally and collegially, are starting to understand their power, but there are rules, there are regulations, there's a right way to do things. There are nonviolent ways to do things. There are ways to use your words and the things that you stand for as power rather than being violent. So I think they're really learning that now. I think now the world is more viral with YouTube and links, and people actually get online and do their research from their phone. They don't actually have to go to the library anymore and read up on what the civil rights movement was or what Malcolm X said or what Martin Luther King said. You can look it up on your phone now. I think the youth today are educating themselves differently and becoming a little more open and understanding where their power lies and that power in protest and power in union and for what's right. You know, the freedom of speech, and I think people are really in a very the racial tensions over the last year or so, I think, have really brought about a lot of people educating themselves on the history of what it means to be American, not white American, not black American, not Mexican American, just American, period, in a history of how we're where we all came from and how we all are here. And even with all this turmoil, we're still the greatest country in the world. You know, just imagine if we can get everything straight. And I think we see that. So I think that outlook in me, the way that I view life, the way that I view experiences, kind of drew me into journalism. I had an opportunity to work with the NFL. I went to NFL offers programs. They offer a broadcast boot camp program. They also offer a journalism program where you have the opportunity to write and pen articles and work with people that have been journalists, lifelong journalists. We work with a Peter King. You work with a John Saunders. You work with some of the best in the business. And I think that perspective of working with them really opened up my eyes to journalism. I do plan on writing a book before my time here is over. A million working titles. But I think this experience that I've been able to have, just as well as me doing this oral history, it's always bigger than me. And you'll see that theme is always bigger than me. If you remember from our first conversation, I wanted this to be able to help someone down the line. I want this book to be able to help someone. I want to be able to help my student athletes. I always think, you know, I've always been, my grandmother was a very star Christian and my grandfather was a Black Panther militant. So I was always getting pulled in two directions in the house. And with those two directions being pulled, I've always been about peace. I've always been about, it's always set that structure up for me, and not to backtrack, but when I talk about opening myself up to understanding different situations and being open to understanding what people don't know. And I think that conflict in the house growing up really prepared me to just look at things from other people's perspective and not be afraid to have a conversation that actually matters.
Weird about the time we've been wrapping up because I think we're close to 9 o'clock. So unless there's something on your mind right now that we might not get to on Thursday when I come back, I think it's a good point to wrap
up. I'm not anything right now.
All right. So this will conclude the third interview, and we'll come back on Thursday and okay. wrap this thing up.
All right. I'm sorry, I get long-winded.
That's what we're here for. So thank you.